This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamoto, MPR. If you're a fan of MPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Grant Hedfield.
Hey, Bolton.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Okay, now Grant, we've been talking about your farming background and various other experiences, but you moved from that eventually into, now it was called FarmSafe, was it?
Yes, so after the Royal Show in 2002, I'd actually was looking for another challenge, to be fair, and this one came up. So FarmSafe was an organisation that came about through discussions with Federated Farmers and ACC at the time, who were quite concerned about the number of rural fatalities and injuries on farm. Probably still hasn't changed much, to be fair. But so I applied for that job, and I started in November 2002, after I finished the ANP. Actually, between the ANP and starting at FarmSafe, I managed to rip over to Sydney. My daughter got married, so I still remember it was in between the two. So that was an organisation that was made up of three educational partners. That was the Telford Rural Polytechnic in Belclutha, Agriculture New Zealand, which was a PGG Wrightson company, and the what was called the Agricultural Industry Training Organisation at the time, now called the Primary Industry Training Organisation. So that was the partnership, what they called the FarmSafe Consortium. So the role was, I was managing this thing. It was a bit of a start-up in 2002.
So you had no background in that at all, but you were more there as a manager, and you had the experts working for you?
Well, that's quite interesting. So we had nothing to be... There was me, it was me.
Where were you based?
Firstly in Keith Street in Palmerston North with Ag New Zealand. And then we moved over to Fielding, and then FarmSafe was run from Fielding.
Did you have support from sort of Massey staff, like was it Ian Laird working on?
No. Okay. So it was quite interesting. So the whole idea is that ACC really wanted to mount what they called a hearts and minds campaign. In other words, they wanted farmers to be able to inculcate normal safe practice that we know what farmers are like. I was one myself. In fact, I was a shocker. But we were trying to say, I'm a recreational pilot. So when I learned to fly, all of the things you do around safety are just part of your training. And so that's where we were trying to move to, was saying, look, there's a whole heap of things you could do slightly differently if you thought about it differently. So we started off on this campaign of what we called an awareness program. We wanted farmers to be aware of the risks they were facing and how they could potentially mitigate some of those risks. And that was
So where did this come from? Was there a body of knowledge about it?
Yes, there was a body of knowledge. ACC had done quite a bit of work on assembling data around, injuries and whatever. And then we just put it together.
So you sort of analysed or made it into an educational
program? We made it into an educational program that was delivered through unit standards, which is how the organisation was funded, basically, through
unit standards. To whom, then? Isn't that a school?
Well, it was funded through Telford Rural Polytech, basically through a program that was funded through, unit standards as taught on the national framework. So that's where it all started, and we were told by the Department of Labour at the time. I still remember the fellow telling me that if you get more than 100 people at these workshops, I'll eat my hat. Well, I sent him a hat to eat. Of course, that was one of the greatest things that I could that I've been able to do. And in the first year, 2003, we We probably put, I'm a bit vague on the figures, but 1,700 farmers attended these courses.
Okay, so it was the farmers, not the farmers' wives?
Everybody, anybody, yep. Workers, I mean, farmers'
who
wives.
Who would tend to turn up?
Well, actually, farmers' wives were really good because often, as we know, women are the conduit to change.
They say for the mental health in the rural areas.
Absolutely, yeah. So we pushed on with that, and then people started asking us for other programs, you know, in terms of different skills. So we ended up doing quad bikes, motorbikes, side-by-sides, chainsaws, four-wheel drives, whole lot of stuff, you know, practical skills.
And people got qualifications from
this? Well, they got unit standards for them, yes.
Which would count towards...
Could count towards a qualification. Yep, absolutely.
Okay, yep.
So that was FarmSafe, and it evolved over the 14 years that I was there. It evolved significantly, and then we ended up trying to help farmers with health and safety plans, you know, because, you know, whilst it wasn't a legal requirement to have it, everybody was saying, actually, it's a good idea if you document stuff. Yeah. And so we were, again, trying to change behaviour around all that stuff. We got heavily involved in agrochemicals, you know, the approved handler certificates for spraying and that sort of stuff.
Approved handler certificate.
Yeah, there was a requirement by there was legislation that required you, without going into too much detail, to have what was called an approved handler certificate if you were using or spraying or storing certain agrochemicals. Not all, but certain. You know, they're in bands. So I won't go into the technicalities of that. So over 14 years, I think that I was there, FarmSafe probably processed in excess of 80-odd thousand individual enrolments. In other words, that's 80,000 individual registrations into one or more of the programs that we were offering. And some of those would be people actually going into multiples, you know, to upskill. So with all the practical school stuff that FarmSafe did, it was a matter of upskilling, you know. So, strangely enough, a lot of people that tell you they know how to ride a quad bike actually haven't got a clue. Yeah. You know, things like active riding and where you've got to shift your weight to, all of those sorts of things. Quite incredible.
Okay.
So anyhow, that took me through till 2015 odd, I think. I retired from
FarmSafe. So hang on there. So there's all these skills. Now, ACC would have picked up on people who didn't have the skills. Where was the development of the skills?
Well, it was quite interesting because, you know, ACC is governed by a whole heap of legislation. At one stage, I can't recall. It's going back a few years, but ACC did give some discount to workplace levies if you'd done certain things, you know. But then they changed that again, you know. Like, everything's cyclic. Yeah. You know, you get... You know how the public service works. They do something. Somebody else comes in and they do something different.
Yeah.
It's pretty hard
but
to keep up with.
But they got researchers looking into the...
Well, interestingly enough, we relied on a little bit of international research as well. And, you know, it was actually like a collaboration of a whole heap of people, you know, in the sector. And that included Federated Farmers, you know, Hawk New Zealand, the police were involved, you know, we were involved on a thing called the Agricultural Health and Safety Council, which was a group of a whole lot of people that had, you know, safety in the sector, you know, at heart, and that included ACC, Department of Labour, or WorkSafe as they now are, feds, whole lot of people, police used to come to that. And a whole lot of people used to come into that as required, you know. So there was a lot of work done, and unfortunately, if we take that journey, probably a couple of years after I left, 18 months after I left, FarmSafe had been consumed into Lincoln University as the single owner, and they stopped funding FarmSafe, I think, at the end of 2016, which was, in my view, a crying shame, because there was no doubt in my mind that over a period of time, you know, it had made a significant difference.
Is that because there's something else that's offering the same sort of thing?
No, funding.
It's just gone.
Purely and simply government funding. We won't.
So a lot of it in your day, then most of the funding came from the government rather than, say, students paying.
Well, a little bit of both. You know, there was a little bit of there was a little bit of you know, look, some of the workshops that were took place commanded a fee.
Yeah.
Some didn't. Some were funded through the education system. Actually, it ended up being various funders because. Again, you know, FarmSafe was funded initially by Telford Rural Polytech, but then it also did some stuff funded through the primary ITO, through other polytechs around the country, you know. So, wherever it could work, it worked, and we actually did a bloody good job of it. It's just a shame that it's not still there. Yeah. But anyhow, you move on, and you do.
Yeah.
What I was going to say, Grant, you said a lot of farmers' wives came to these meetings.
Yes.
Because they were the ones who were there when an accident happened. They were there to pick up the pieces.
Well, indeed. And you know, one of the things that people never think about, Jane, is you know, if you're the principal worker on a farm, and to be fair, a lot of husbands and wives actually poke in pretty equal workloads at times, you know.
Yes, we did.
in family operations.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you actually look at the overall costs, it's not actually the fact that, a husband might injure himself. You've then got to think, what happens? What's the downstream effect? I've got to get labour in if he can't work.
Yes.
Somebody might have to drive him to hospital and back and to therapy and back.
Yes.
And you have all sorts of things. You know, he might be the coach of the local rugby team at the school. Well, they're buggered, you know. And I think in a lot of cases, people never thought about the broader impact of actually saying, well, actually, I've stuffed my leg, I can't walk.
Exactly.
And so that was sort of the driver around all of it. I mean, to be honest, it's probably, you know, it was a hugely enjoyable 14 years for me, apart from the times when funding became a bit of an issue. And as the chief executive of FarmSafe, you know, there was a whole lot of other things going on that towards the end made it, you know, quite significantly stressful.
Yeah.
But we achieved a lot, and I think that's the thing that's important.
You've highlighted a problem with ACC, actually, that I've come across a similar issue in a slightly different circumstance. If you've got, say, a couple, that the guy has a particular skill, so he's working, she does the office work, so there's their business. And if he gets injured, I mean, I've had some of these people say to me, they go to the doctor and he's saying, first of all, okay, we can put in an ACC claim, and then finds out that he's self-employed. So, well, there's no point, because if he stops working, the business stops, and he's just got to carry on.
Well, I think at the end of the day, you know, going back and look at, you know, we're nearly 6 years since I've been out of this game, and I've moved on, but we did used to encourage people to, you know, if they are self-employed, and, you know, self-employed people often have a lower income,
but
you can insure yourselves through an ACC package, and that was the... excuse me. Mm. Yep.
Yep.
Mm. Anyhow, so that was FarmSafe. Interesting. And then I was a bit young to retire, so I did a little bit of consulting work for 18 months, and then I did retire. And then I thought, I'll have a crack at local body politics, and that's what I've done.
You just thought of it because of the family tradition, or you were asked
it's not a family tradition, because apart from Dad, my siblings would run a mile, I suspect. But look, you know, I've lived in the community, you know, in the Manawatu, in the broader Manawatu since 1989. And I guess, like Dad, you know, if you've got time on your hands and you feel you can contribute, it's a good thing to do.
Okay.
I did have a crack at a by-election, actually, when Ian McKelvey stood down as mayor and became the MP for Rangitiki. Mm. And goodness, that would have been about 2012, I think. So I had a crack then, and I was unsuccessful. And, you know, the timing was never... just didn't fit for me.
Yeah.
And of course, once I'd sort of finished 18 months of doing consulting work, I'd sort of had enough, to be honest. I'd had enough of the education game and the nuances within it. Mm. and I think, you know, I thought, well, I'll give it another crack. So I did in 2019, and And all I can say is, well, bugger me, I got elected.
Yeah. What was your image of that before, and from your father's experience? It didn't put you off.
Well, no, I don't think so. And Dad was pretty... I'm just not quite sure how to describe it, actually. He was never a... he's never a show pony, you know, so there was never anything really flashy to see about what Dad did. He just toiled away in the background. And, of course, when he became the mayor of Kapiti, there was no reticulated water and there was no reticulated sewerage, you know. Mm. Every house in Parabram had a bore or a water tank, and and every little house poked its sewerage into a septic tank, and you know, and that was it. So the times, for the time that he was mayor, it was just huge infrastructure build. But he talked a little bit about his time on the local government commission, but never at great length. So I'm not sure that Dad was a huge influence, if you know what I mean, in terms of my decision to have a crack myself. But having said that, subconsciously, probably was, you know, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
I just actually, I sort of, every now and then I just rue the fact that the old bugger's not around, for me to still have a bit of a chin wag with. He'd be really pleased that I've done it. I know he would. And I'm sure we would disagree on a few things, and I'm sure that he would be the first to give me some advice whether I wanted it or not.
Now, I've just done some recording with a former MP who was... in Parliament for 6 years, and he said when he started he was told it'll take you 5 years to really learn the ropes, and after which you'll become effective. And he said, yeah, and that was true, and after the 6 years he was voted out. But is it something that there's a long learning curve
There is a lot to learn, but I have to say, when I went into this, I it wasn't whimsical by any means for me. So for the year... pretty much a year prior to me handing my nomination form in, I'd sat in on most of the council meetings at the Manawatu District Council and the public, the parts that were allowed, and also I sat in on most of the policy and planning committee meetings for that 12 months as well. So, you know, look, I had a fair bit of an idea of what was going on, what the business of council was. But it's like anything, it's not till you dip the old quill in the ink pot that you know what you're going to write sometimes, you know.
Yeah.
And I think there's a little bit of that. And I've been very lucky as a first-term councillor that the mayor basically appointed a deputy mayor as a mentor for me, which I've actually found very useful.
Yeah.
And Jane will probably tell you the process of anybody trying to mentor me is probably something that's actually quite challenging. But the Manawatu's deputy mayor Michael Ford has been hugely helpful to me, and he's a set of ears that I can throw anything at that will give me an answer. And clearly, we don't agree on some things, but we agree on a lot of things. But it's really useful being able to have that feedback. So I found that very useful as a first term, but.
So that's important for process, say, but were there any particular issues that you felt, if you're elected, you can try and achieve?
No, not at all. Because one of the things that I actually said in my campaign is that you'll get no promises from me, because I think that's puerile or futile or whatever you'd like to call it. At the end of the day, I'm one vote round the table. Mm-hmm. So to promise anything around a table of 11 is actually...
Well, not necessarily promising something, but areas that you think, you would like to have an impact in those things. Were you motivated for policy reasons?
I'll tell you what motivates me is that I believe strongly in the process of democracy. Mm. And whatever we do, we need to protect the integrity and the process of democracy. And I'm just thinking the way things are in this modern world is sometimes that democracy is being a little bit attacked. Mm. So, my principle, if you want me to say, why do I do this? And it's say it is about fairness, so that everybody's treated equally, and that, you know, we actually respect the principle of democracy. I think that's actually for me the principal driver. I'm interested in what happens. I'm interested in how council spends its ratepayers' money, you know. And I'm interested in the political process, you know, otherwise I wouldn't be there. And I guess, you know, look, it should be a forum for solid debate. I've got quite thick skin, so I certainly wouldn't describe myself as a snowflake, if you're allowed to use that term. And, you know, I believe, you know, solid debate around anything's a good thing, because one thing we know is that whatever you have in the community, you'll have disparate views. And at the end of the day, there's a few things that you do have to do, in my view, and that's you've got to listen to the views of the community, but you've also got to be, in my view, and this is only my view, is that you've got to be careful that the views of the minority don't supersede the views of the silent majority. And the silent majority is actually, it's pretty hard to be in touch with everybody in the community, you know, but you do get a bit of a feel. But, you know, look, there's plenty of challenges in front of councils at the moment, and you know, with all the reforms that government are proposing. I don't know what the answers are. I can guarantee you that I'll agree with some and I'll firmly disagree with others. But that's the process of debate, you know. And
in some areas, there's sort of a party politics creeping into the local government area.
Well, as I've, you know, stated earlier, you know, I've been Ian McKelvey's campaign chair for the last two elections, so I guess that paints my political colours on the tape recorder, or whatever you call that thing. So I make no apologies for that. However, I do not think that standing under a political banner in local bodies, as I think happens in Palmerston North, is at all useful. In fact, I'm actually opposed to it, because my view is, whilst I'm happy to share with my colleagues my political view and everything else, I have not stood on the Manawatu District Council as a National Party representative, for instance. I am not encumbered with any party policy.
You could have followed Andy Asquith's approach. He stood as independent Labour, so the Labour Party.
Well, no,
shock, horror, how dare. He said, I should disclose my leanings, but I'm not affiliated to the party.
Well, in a way, with all due respect to Andy, that's actually bollocks in my view. So I'd just like to keep party politics right out of it, you know, because they're entirely different, you know, if you think about it. And if you think about some of the issues that local government now has, most of the issues that we have are foisted by legislation from central government on local government.
Yeah.
And then central government have then got the temerity to turn around and criticise local government.
Yeah. And are they resourced?
Well, we're not funded, you know. If you look at the funding models, that's, again, it's another issue up for debate. Central government get all the funding.
Yeah.
And, you know, they make a lot of the rules that impose costs on local government. I'll be careful what I say on that one, Stuart, because, look, at the end of the day, it's a view that I have, and I think regardless of which government we have, all governments have been responsible for foisting, you know, nonsense on local government that, in my view, is not necessary at times.
Yeah.
But then a lot of what central governments do, a lot of people can take the view that what they do is nonsense and not sensible at times either. So, but that's a debate for another day.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, there's another term, the Fourth Estate, which is also involved in politics. What's your view on the press coverage of...
Well, interestingly enough, I do have a view on that. We recently had a media commentator at the annual general meeting of the Rangitiki electorate branch of the National Party, which was actually, and I think Jane was there, it was actually very interesting. So, you know, look, if you go back a little while in time, we actually used to get news and facts. And I think what we get from the media now is subjective, not objective. Yeah. And I rue, when you look at the my view is, when you look at the quality of the stuff that we read in the media now, most of it's, I'll rephrase that, a lot of it's opinions from people that probably shouldn't be giving an opinion. And, you know, look, there's one or two journalists around who actually do go hunting for the facts. And right at this point in time, I think we've got a pretty bloody ordinary standard of journalism. And you know, we... and look, it doesn't matter who's in government. Forget politics. The role of the Fourth Estate is actually to challenge, question, and make sure that what the government say they're doing, they're actually doing. If they're promising to do something, make sure they're doing it. But we're not getting that at the moment. And that's all part of, you know, the comments I range.
It's the funding model thing that we have now. We've moved to the internet, and so newspapers and TV and so on, they don't get the same sort of funding for... and then people get snapped up in PR. So as soon as a journalist gets some experience, then they can get higher salaries in PR, where they're no longer looking for the impartial questioning.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic, and I guess, you know, it's easy to criticise mainstream media. But look, at the end of the day, you know, the government have thrown, you know, millions of dollars at them. Well, you know, how long
but,
do
you... But you see, part of your role now, you have a Facebook presence as well, don't
you? Yeah, look, I swore that I'd never get, you know, involved in Facebook, and I guess, like many of my my age group, probably thought the same. However, I put my... I got the white flag out, and I surrendered when I discovered that if I wanted to find out what my grandchildren were doing, that I needed to be on social media. And so, look, I did. And you look, I do have a page, that a personal page, and I've got a page that's you know, my Manawatu District Councillor page. But look, I'm not a techno retard, but you know, look, I struggle a little bit with it, and when I read some of the stuff on social media, I think, good God, why the hell do I bother? You know, because there's all sorts of acerbic, ill-informed, quite brutal crap, if I can put it that way, that is on social media. And I think the keyboard warriors, you know, honestly, you know, the intellect behind some of the comments that I read is is questionable, and I think, you know, goodness gracious me, you know, what's the world coming to? So I do have a social presence. I do understand social media, Stuart, but I look, you know...
Do you get much feedback from people?
Not a lot, but I guess you've got to post a bit to get feedback, don't you? And look, you know, I guess, quite frankly, you know, you probably need to do a bit of that around election time to get a bit of hoo-ha out there, you know, but... You know, elections are a lottery as well, aren't they, to be fair? And look, you know, my view is that I got elected on for 3 years, so I'll just do my best for 3 years regardless. And I'll do the things that I think are right and best for the community, you know. And you know, it's important that, you know, that it's just so difficult now with all the stuff that's coming at local government. And you get limited time to try and take a community on a journey with you, whatever that might be. And council is a fair tucker for, you know, criticism, as you know. You know, it's...
I suppose the other side, or another dimension, is the who have the most influence, or what sort of influence do the elected representatives have, as opposed to the salary council officers, and the sort of advice coming in that's guiding you on policy decisions.
Well, I think that's an interesting topic, and I think without making a direct quote, I think there is a view that, you know, in some cases, in councils around the country, and I'm definitely not talking about our local councils around here, but there is a view around some councils in the country that, you know, the councils are run by the chief executives, not by the elected members. However, I would categorically say that that's not the case for our council, and quite clearly, it's not the case on my reflection, for Palmerston or Rangitiki or Horowhenua, you know, councils. I'm not qualified to comment. But you know, anecdotally, that's out there, you know. So in our council, the answer is no. You know, we have some very good systems, I believe, in the Manawatu District of having informal conversations with staff, elected members. and that allows the staff to get a feel for where elected members are thinking before they actually produce stuff and present it to council. Yeah. And I think that's actually a very sensible way of doing things.
Communication.
Yeah. Well, that's actually something that Mayor Helen has introduced.
Oh, good.
And whilst it's not universally accepted, I think most of us agree that there's a lot of positivity around, you know, that process.
Yes.
But you know, like everything, you've got to be entirely respectful, you know, and that if you think about, you know, the formal arrangement of council, which is that the chief executive is council's only employee,
yes,
having the ability to sort of circumnavigate that, which is essentially at the behest of the chief executive, to have that interaction and communicate in a, you know, in a respectful way, actually makes life a lot easier, and I think ends and leads to better outcomes.
Do you think there's the appropriate skill base for the expert staff in council?
Well, it's actually quite interesting. I can only talk for Manawatu District. Some very good staff, and unfortunately, things come along. Government again, you know, like Kāinga Ora, can now do their own consenting. So what are they doing? They're stealing staff from councils and paying them more.
Now you say Kāinga Ora, can you explain that
for I won't get into too much detail, but you know, so Housing New Zealand now have the ability to do their own consenting for building and that sort of stuff, so they're grabbing consenting and building staff and all that sort of stuff from councils. You know, there's a shortage of planning staff, all those things that we have to do, that we're required to do by legislation. And then the bloody government come along and they nick all your employees and pay them more. Well, we should just tell them to bugger off back to Wellington, shouldn't we? You know. But anyhow, you know, that's it. Okay. But look, it's an interesting one.
So how do you see yourself going? Obviously, you say you're there for 3 years and you're going to do your best for that.
Yep.
Given the chance, you'd like to be there for another 10?
Well, I think, again, do you want me to be a politician? You know, look at the end of the day.
Show your grandchildren that way.
Well, exactly. Look, at the end of the day, you know, that's a discussion that I'll have with my partner.
Yeah.
Because clearly, you know, this impacts on our home life. And, you know, like for trips away and stuff, you know, we have to try and fit it around my council diary. So I'm involved in a few things. So it's a discussion that I'll need to have with my partner. And, you know, collectively we'll make a decision.
Okay.
So that's a good political answer.
So is it a big impact on they talk about MPs and the cost to family, but in...
Well, in terms of MPs, you know, they're away from home a hell of a lot. So for me, it's not so much that, but it's, you know, we're both retired and we want my partner especially got things we want to do, so we try and fit that in amongst my diary. It doesn't always work.
So what sort of time are you in terms of hours, or is it every Wednesday evening you've got a meeting or something?
No,
is
so
it data,
we,
lots
so
of daytime,
count, council's every second Thursday.
Yeah.
And then in amongst that
daytime or evening?
Daytime. Yeah, starts at 8:30 and goes through to about 3:30, 4 o'clock.
Okay.
So that's every second Thursday. I'm liaison councillor for Rangawahia, so you know I head out to there every 2 or 3 months for the community group meetings. I'm on the joint Palmerston North Manawatu Strategic Committee. I'm on the Cedar Electoral College. I've got a whole lot of things that I'm involved with, you know. So and on our focus groups as well. And on audit and risk. So, you know, so those are all, you know...
Extras. It's not just every second Thursday.
No, it's not just every second Thursday, but there's also a lot of reading, lot of reading.
So you've got sort of constituency work as well, or people phoning you up with problems and things? Or?
No, well, not too often with a bit of luck, you know. But, you get people... People will contact you, you know, and I think it's a bit of a random choice. They'll look on the council list and decide who they're going to ring.
Yeah.
But, you know, the people that you know always have a crack at you about certain things. And the people that you mix with, but there is a lot of reading, and you know, and you know, surprisingly enough, I you know, if I'm going to debate something, I like to do a bit of research, and sometimes that takes quite a bit of time. But look, on the whole, it's pretty enjoyable. And
what's a special training for you?
Well, I considered my life skills, to be honest.
Yeah,
they're pretty broad. And, you know, I think, you know, it's placed me pretty well, you know.
So you sort of have a mentor and you can find your own
absolutely,
way.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's the way that I personally like to operate.
Yep.
Firm believer in that.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.